history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always come away better than when we started. We're educated, we're entertained, so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This time, we not only get to say thank you to Roger Jensen for his service to our country, we also get to say happy 100th birthday. Roger was born September 12, 1920 in Parlier, California. He's known for his significant contributions to the agriculture industry, which we'll touch on later, as well as his philanthropy. For decades to come, families whose kids are benefiting from treatment at Valley Children's Hospital just outside of Fresno, California, will be able to find peace and comfort in the beautiful Roger and Margaret Jensen Family Chapel. And at his alma mater, Fresno State, an endowed scholarship fund ensures that ag students will benefit from the Jensen's generosity for generations to come. None of that would have come to pass if Roger didn't survive some hairy moments as one of the youngest B-29 pilots in World War II. In fact, Roger has the distinction of dropping the very last bomb on the very last bombing mission before the Japanese surrender. We'll get to all of that, but as always, we like to begin with childhood. So, Roger, I want to know, what do you remember about those days when it was you and your mom and dad and your younger brother?
We sold the ranch where I was born and moved to Selma. My parents were very religious, and they wanted to be close to the Danish Lutheran Church in Selma, and Parlier was just too far to go for them, so they wanted to get in, and that's the reason they sold that ranch and bought a ranch closer to the church. So I had that kind of parental experience of their desires. When I went to Selma High School, I played on their football team. I was selected the player of the year, and unbelievable, I was a center. can you imagine? Anyway, I had a nice bunch of guys, and we had the champion team, and the American Legion at that time made awards, and the American Legion was a pretty strong organization, at least in some of these communities, and Selma was one of them. Mm-hmm. And so they had made out these awards at the advice of the coaches and so forth. And I played in the band.
What'd you play?
I played the tuba.
All right.
But I worked a lot. We lived on North McCall, about a mile north of the town of Selma. I just wanted to get some spending money, and so I went to work at a grocery store there, and I knew that I'd have to work to. We didn't have much money. The family didn't, and so I figured I'd do my own, and so I just did a lot of work. All I did was I did take time to play football. I played, did a little bit of track work, hurdles, but it just took up too much time from my work schedule. So I worked for Justice and Supermarket, headquartered at Reedley.
I'm curious. I know this a long time ago, but I see all the things you've done in your life since then, and I'm wondering, as that boy, did you have some ideas? Hey, when I grow up, these are the things I'm going to do. Did you have some dreams or ambitions?
No.
Had aviation occurred to you at all?
Yes, it had. There was a plane that flew into and landed in an alfalfa field or a flat area that was supposed to be a duplicate of the plane that Lindbergh flew.
Spirit of St. Louis?
Yeah. So my dad said, let's go out and see that plane. So we did, and took a flight in that. So I took a short flight, and it created an interest on my part to fly. But interestingly enough, after the war was over, I was not interested in flying anymore. I just felt I had survived so many trying times with weather and different experiences. The other pilot, for instance, talking about experiences. On our first mission, we had all the, it's dark and we could see the explosions and the other pilot says, let's get out of here, the hell with dropping these bombs. Drop those bombs, let's go, hell with. And they actually had to hold him back. And so I go on the bomb run. He chickened out and I never thought he would.
Wow.
You know, and so you just don't know. And on my first crew, the other pilot couldn't fly that. He had a lot of hours, but he just couldn't fly that B-29. And when we were training down in Puerto Rico to be out of sight, boy, he hit that when he was landing. And he just couldn't handle that airplane. And he had a lot of hours with B-17s. He finally just, he just broke down and cried and said, I can't do it.
Mm.
And so they took him up. He just felt sorry for him. He just said, I can't fly this airplane.
Mm.
So, you know, you see these experiences of personalities that you had exposed to. And I was just too eager, I guess, to quit.
Well, and maybe it takes a, you know, a star high school football player to be strong enough to wrestle one of those. I guess that's something I think a lot of people don't think about. The physical requirements to fly that plane.
Yeah, it was a hard plane to fly, to control. And anyway, we survived.
Well, I'm glad you did.
So am I.
Yeah, a lot of people are. I think your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids are real thankful for that. And speaking of, you went to Fresno State.
Yeah.
Is that where you met your wife, at Fresno State?
That's right. I did. I met her there. I met her in 1938. And we were married in 41. And we were married for 76 years before I lost her. I've been very fortunate for a lot of reasons.
What was it about her that made such an impression on you?
For one thing, she had an ag background. Her parents were farmers, and so she'd been raised in an ag environment. She was interesting. She lived in Fig Garden, and she went to Fresno High. And the buses didn't go out this far. So when she was 14 year old, her dad bought her a little Nash automobile to go to school. Different times, you know.
Very different.
And she was just a fun gal, and we hit it off together. There were times when we had our problems before we got married. We'd get upset with each other and so forth. But we'd get back together. And, well, it's just like a marriage. A marriage has its trying times also, and you just work them out. And this present generation, the first time they don't agree, they divorce. They don't go through it as well.
Well, I often ask when I meet someone who had as long of a marriage as yours, what the secret is or what the advice. So for 76 years, you found a way to keep it going, huh?
Yeah, you just work it out.
You graduate from Fresno State in 1941. In fact, I think you said your last semester was up at Huntington Lake at the summer program?
Yeah.
Where there's an awful fire burning right now, the Creek Fire.
Yeah, that's right. I think we've got a cabin up there. We think it's probably been burned.
Mm. I think most people listening might be surprised to know there was a summer school there that you could take college classes up at 7,000 feet in the Sierra Nevada.
Yeah.
What was that like up there?
Oh, it was pretty primitive. There was no enclosed classrooms or anything like that. And there was a restricted curriculum. I needed one program to get my degree, and I didn't get it at Fresno State. And they had it available up there, and so that's the reason it was up there. So I ended up, years later, buying property up at Huntington around the property that was owned by Fresno State, where all the apartments and buildings are up there now is on land that we developed.
Oh, wow. Yeah, there's something else I don't know if I've ever asked you before, but I'm certainly interested in your answer, because so many of the veterans I've talked to over the years, when it comes to December 7th, 1941, they know exactly where they were and how they found out what had happened at Pearl Harbor. Do you have a memory of that?
Yes. I had gone to Sunday school that Sunday morning. My brother and I had, and so we didn't go to church. We came back to the house, and I picked up a .22 rifle I had. No, it was a .410. And went down in a slough on Manning Avenue right near McCall. There's a big slough there. It was dry, and my brother and I went down there to hunt jackrabbits, just something to do. And so we were hunting those jackrabbits, and so when it came about noontime, we figured we better get back to the car and get lunch. The folks had come back from church. So I got in the car and turned on the radio, and that's how I found out about December 7th, 1941.
And I'm just imagining, knowing where you went to high school in Selma, that you must have had some classmates who were Americans of Japanese ancestry.
I was practically raised with Japanese. I went to school in Parlier for a while. We had more Japanese students in the class than we did Caucasians. We had Japanese people that lived on the ranch and housing we had for them, and I would spend time with them. I'd go down and eat boiled noodles with them. Boy, that was a treat. You know, so I was very friendly with the Japanese. I trusted them. They were good people. They worked hard, and they couldn't own property at that time, so they had to work for somebody. They were really discriminated against.
Well, that's what I was thinking, that, you know, if you've grown up with these people, they're your classmates, they're on the football team with you, they're on the teams you're playing against, that, you know, those few months that followed Pearl Harbor must have been hard to see them deal with what they had to deal with.
Yeah. Just awful. We do some awful dumb things. Hmm. And I'm wondering if we're still doing them.
Well, I'm sure we could find a lot of opinions on that.
Yep, it's a different world.
It is.
Well, our total culture has changed. You know, we got an entirely different culture than what I was raised in. We never thought about locking our homes when we'd leave or leaving something out. It wasn't stolen. It was a different culture.
Well, on that note, is there something you think here in 2020 that we can learn from the time where you risked your life, where 16 million Americans risked their lives in World War II? Is there something from that era you think that would apply to what we're facing today?
I think you've got to appreciate the freedom. It's just, you know, we have more freedom than anybody else in the world, and we've had that privilege, and today it's not as highly accepted as it was in my times. And so, of course, I don't want to get into whether I think people should kneel and all of that. You can imagine how I feel about that. And we've got so many advantages today that we didn't have in those days. The work ethic has changed. Mm. Besides it's just, people are just different.
I'm sorry, I know I'm digging in here at different things, but Pearl Harbor happened. And a couple weeks later, you got married? That must have been an interesting time to get married.
Well, we had engaged in September.
Uh-huh.
And we had scheduled to be married in February. And so when the bomb started dropping, he says, well, if we're going to enjoy any married life, we better hurry up and do it. Mm-hmm. And we did. So that's how that happened. Otherwise, we would have been married in February.
And so every single one of those missions, you flew in a B-29. She's back here in the States wondering if you're ever going to make it back.
Yeah.
Was there ever a time where you wondered, where you thought, I might not make it back and see her again?
I didn't zero in on that. I mean, I just had faith that the good Lord would be taking care of me.
And we're going to hear some examples of just how that happened. But right now, it's time for our first break. Still to come, the unique path Roger Jensen took to the cockpit of a B-29, some of his experiences in the air, and why he's so thankful for the men who fought so valiantly to secure the island of Iwo Jima. Find photos and a short video of Roger at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with a World War II bomber pilot celebrating his 100th birthday this weekend. When Roger Jensen joined the military, he already had a degree in commerce from Fresno State, and he and his wife Margaret had already enjoyed 9 months of marriage.
Went into the service in September of 42 and went into the infantry as a private, but then I was assigned to officers training course in Fort Benning, and so I became a second lieutenant in the Army. I had wanted to get into the Air Force, but they weren't taking cadets at that point. I was disappointed about that and went through different trainings as a first lieutenant in the infantry, and ended up in a Camp Meade in Baltimore, Maryland, which was pretty close to the Pentagon. And so I thought, well, what the heck? I'm going to go over to the Pentagon and see if they do things. So I called in AFSA one day and went over to the Pentagon and went to the recruiting person over there and said, I'd like to join the Air Force. And he said, well, why do you want to do that? And I said, well, I've always wanted to be in the Air Force and fly, and hadn't been accepted, and I'd like to have an opportunity to do so. Well, he says, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll make orders transferring you from the infantry to Air Force, well, of course, as part of the Army at that point, for pilot training. And if you do not pass the physical and mental requirements of pilot training, you go back to your infantry. And I says, well, that's a good deal. So I had an incentive, so to speak, to stay in the Air Force, which I did. And so I was transferred to the Air Force and went through pilot training and physically and, you know, different stations, and then went through 3 or 4 different airfields before I got my wings, and I took my training in grade as an officer, and so my classmates were all cadets, but so I was an officer with cadets in pilot training in Air Force. After getting my wings, I was assigned to B-17 training. So I went through B-17 training and ended up getting a crew to fly missions in Europe, and during that process of completing, I completed my B-17 and was putting my crew together to start flying those missions, and they said, we want to transfer you to the B-29 program. And I said, well, I don't have those kind of hours. We're just asking you or telling you we want you in the B-29 program. So I says, okay, and I went up there and I looked at that plane at that point and wondered how in the world that thing could ever get up in the air, of course. But I took through that training and it was interesting. After taking transition and training in the B-29, I was assigned to a group and sent to Guam. And this particular group, the 315th Wing, was made up of, I don't recall how many planes, but I think about 150 total. And they said that this wing will not have any armament. They took all the armament all off the 29. All they do is left a couple of guns in the tail end of the plane. And they took all the rest of the armament off. And they said our first missions were flying up at 35,000 feet to drop bombs, and found out that we weren't very accurate because of the height and the wind that was involved. And so the reason they thought that they could have the accuracy at 35,000, we were the only wing in the Air Force that had the APQ-7, which was a secret radar device for bombsight. And so we had a radar bomb sight officer in our crew. And so they sent us down to Puerto Rico because for security purposes, they didn't want to have the public in the United States see this plane because of the bomb sight. We had an additional wing underneath the original wing. It was much smaller, but it was a wing that manipulated the bomb sight. So we, like I say, we were the only ones that had that, and they put us down to flying night missions at low levels because with that bomb sight, we didn't have to see the target. That bomb sight was just super. And so we flew our missions then at night at relatively low levels, and the accuracy of the anti-aircraft of the Japanese for operation at night was rather insufficient for them, so they weren't very accurate. So they'd shoot it off, but they didn't know how to get to us. And I feel as though that we knew that they had their fighters come up and fly beside us so they could transfer the height and the speeds we were going to the anti-aircraft people down on the ground. And that was the best thing they could have. And so very few people got hit by the anti-aircraft, but I was one of the lucky ones that did get hit, so to speak. And I lost an engine just as we were dropping the bombs on about the fifth or sixth mission we were on of flying from Guam to Tokyo. And we were assigned to bomb nothing but the oil refineries and oil and gasoline fuel storage facilities. And that was... We didn't drop firebombs and that sort of thing. We had our specific targets that we were assigned to. So, fortunately, we just dropped our bombs when they got hit and lost an engine. And so I took drastic action to get out of the range of the anti-aircraft and just put it into a nose drive. And one of our briefings before our missions, we had, I remember so well, that Bull Halsey was there, and he told us, he says, "If you guys get hit, and if you will land on water, I'll get you. Don't worry about that." He says, "You decide what you want to do, but if you get on water, we'll get you." So I thought, and that decision was made up to us ahead of time, that we, if we were hit, we could stay with the plane. We could go to ditch and or whatever action that we wanted to take. So we had decided in our crew that we would stay with the plane. Because if we bailed out over Japan, we knew what kind of actions and treatment that we would get, because particularly the B-29 pilots, they just tortured, you know, to no end. So we decided to stay with that plane, and so we dived down to a real low level and was able to get into Iwo Jima. And Iwo Jima had only been secured a short period of time by us when all this happened, and it was raining, of course. Weather was always a problem on our deals, and it was at night, and so we called in at Iwo for emergency landing at night, and it was raining, and they said, "Well, come on in." He said, "We're under attack, or under a raid now, but you can land." And so we did land on this runway in the dark and the raining. They had us, we didn't have much, they wouldn't put the lights on the runway, so it was a scary kinds of situation. After we did land, they escorted us to a parking place and wanted us to get out of the plane as soon as we can to get into a bomb shelter, which we did. We got in there, and there was water, and I remember there was water inside this it was a mess. But we were all whole, and we were on the ground and safe. We were depending on the repair people that was being at Iwo Jima that would get our engines going again. And it so happened that the shrapnel that did knock out our engine was right below my seat. It did enter the plane, and it was right close to me, and I've still got the... And it had hit the oil filter, and so it eliminated the oil availability to that engine. So you had to cut it. And so we had to feather that engine. So anyway, we stayed there until they fixed our plane. And then we flew, of course, back to Guam. At that point, they had to change an engine for us because it was not operating up to standard. So we were delayed a little bit about getting an engine because they said the people at GE were on strike. They were making the engines for these things. And it really teed us off to think that these people would be on strike when we were about making planes.
Yeah.
And we were flying missions. But anyway, we got the plane, and it was put on. And
can I ask you some questions about that mission? Because you described it very well, but I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. How old were you at this point?
I was 24.
24 years old. And how many guys in your crew?
There was 10 of us.
10 guys. And so you drop your bombs, and you get hit. Is that a jolt? Do you feel the plane shudder? What happens in that moment?
Well, of course, we could feel shrapnel explosions in our missions. They'd explode, but we were lucky that we weren't getting hit, but they weren't very accurate.
But this time they got you.
Yeah.
And you knew instantly, right?
Oh, yeah. We lost the oil pressure in that engine. We knew that we couldn't use that engine then without oil.
But you had decided ahead of time as a crew that if this happened, you would stay with the plane?
Yes, yes.
So you didn't have to make that decision
in
the moment?
No, that was done ahead of time. We all agreed that we'd stay with the plane. If it crashed, we crashed with it. If it, whatever.
And there are, there have been people over the years who have suggested all those Marines who died at Iwo Jima, it wasn't really that important to take that island. I guess you probably feel differently.
Yeah, that Iwo Jima battle was just unbelievable, and we were so fortunate to be the recipients of the result of acquiring that at a huge price, huge price. So it was the only place that we could land a B-29 between Japan and Guam. So I assume that the top brass, realizing that, made the decision to pay the price, which was a lot of American lives were lost there, as well as Japanese.
And when you're on the way there, is there any doubt that you're going to make it? Was that questionable?
We felt it would get us partway there. But we knew it wouldn't get us all the way. Of course, we weren't very comfortable. We were kind of iffy.
You're flying low and slow?
Yeah.
Which makes you more vulnerable, too, right?
Well, after we got away from Japan at night, we were not subject to enemy aircraft, really. So we weren't worrying about that. We were worrying about getting there.
Well, and it sounds like you had plenty to worry about because it's dark, it's raining, and you finally get to land at Iwo Jima, but the Japanese are bombing the airstrip.
Aircraft that came in, I think, from Okinawa to Iwo Jima, and they were attacking the airport, but they knocked them out before they got there. So we were subject to the alert, but there was not an effective bombing that took place by the Japanese.
But you don't know that while you're huddled in the wet bomb shelter waiting, huh?
No, we don't know those things. But anyway, that was about, our fifth or sixth mission. Then, on August the 6th, Colonel Tippetts and his aircraft, the Enola Gay, was stationed at Tinian and dropped the first bomb. And we were returning from a mission from Japan when they dropped that bomb, and we saw that the smoke and debris and the from where we had dropped our bombs, of course, at a different location.
Right.
We were headed home, but we felt and so then we said, look over there, and there was all that debris, that smoke and stuff.
And you didn't know what that was, right?
No, we didn't know at that point.
So that had to be, I'm just assuming you'd never seen an explosion cloud like that before.
No. But it was announced to us before we got back to Guam that it was an atomic bomb, and boy, we were elated to think that we did have the atomic bomb and it had been authorized to utilize it. The Japanese didn't respond with any surrender and it was about 3 or 4 days later, dropped at Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm.
And then after Nagasaki, we were assigned to fly another mission, even though that we wondered certainly they would surrender. I mean, they had been offered. And so they assigned us to fly a mission to northern Hokkaido, which would be the longest bombing mission we had from the Marianas by the 29s that had been flown.
That mission would also leave Roger with a unique distinction. And wait till you hear about the unintended but significant consequence that final bombing mission of World War II carried. The story of that mission is told in a book called The Last Mission by Jim Smith. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHSmaster will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 100-year-old Roger Jensen of Fresno, California. I mentioned that book, The Last Mission by Jim Smith. It gives you the big picture of a bombing mission on the final day of hostilities in World War II. You'll find Roger Jensen's name on page 248 of the latest edition. But even better, we get to hear in his own words and his own voice how it unfolded that day for the B-29 named Horrible Monster.
We were assigned to be in that group to fly that mission. So we put on extra fuel, and we weighed more than we ever had on any other mission. We had to reduce our bomb load to accommodate additional fuel to be able to fly that extra distance. One of the weaknesses of B-29 was the engines weren't good. And so we'd lose some planes because they just couldn't get off, just couldn't get going. And our airfield that we had on Guam was situated so that at the end of the runway, there was a cliff. And from that top of that cliff to the ocean was about 75 feet. And so we, as soon as we got to the edge, we went down, to get speed up to fly. And so we were in the number two position to take off that day. We were right behind the theater. And as we started down the runway, there was two runways we used. And there was a plane that would take off every minute on each runway. So there was a plane taking off every 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And there was probably 125 or 50 planes destined to fly that mission. Well, we had an engine that was not operating correctly as we started down the runway, so we aborted and went back to our stand. And so we said, well, we guess we don't fly that mission. But the ground crew got it fixed. And by the time they got it fixed, the last plane that had taken off for the mission was about 15 or 20 minutes anyway. And so we asked them, do we take off or do we stay here? It's up to you. If you want to stay, okay. If you want to go, go. We said to go. So we went, and so we were the last plane to take off. So we were the last plane to drop that bomb load, and that bomb load was dropped. We dropped our bombs less than an hour before Hirohito accepted unconditional surrender. And so we were the last plane, because of that situation of our takeoff time, to be the last plane to drop the bombs in that mission, which was the longest mission that was flown, combat mission out of Marianas in World War II. We were the last plane to drop the bomb on Japanese land. So we got word about an hour after we had dropped that one that Herr Hato had accepted the surrender.
So you're on your way back. And for people to understand, when you say the longest mission, so you're going from Guam all the way to the northern end of Japan.
Which was Hokkaido was is the area. It was the last only oil-producing drilling field that Japan had. That was the reason for the mission. They said, we found out different later, but that's what they told us.
Well, there's a lot you found out later, and I want to touch on that, but so we understand how long this was. How many hours?
Round 17 trip? Hours is the longest mission. We were 17 hours from takeoff to landing.
That's a long time. But you're on the way back from dropping your bombs, and you hear on the radio Japan has surrendered?
Yeah.
That's a pretty unique place to be to get that news.
It's a good place to be any place when you get that kind of news in that circumstances. So everybody on the crew went to sleep, except me. I never did sleep on the plane. Other people could sleep when after we dropped the planes and headed back home. And, you know, it was tired. Our average mission was about 12 hours, 12 to 13 hours. Mm-hmm. But this one was 17, and so I just didn't feel comfortable about sleeping, and so they could always figure I'd be going. And had a wonderful crew and a flight engineer. All of our crew members were well-experienced people. They weren't recruits, so it was really wonderful you have that kind of support and ability that that you had in your crew. And so anyway, that was the experience we had up to the time of surrender. Then what happened during that last mission at the Imperial Palace, we didn't know about that. That was secret information and was never divulged for 40 years. And at the end of 40 years, we were told what happened at the Imperial Palace during up to the surrender deal, that we were so effective, were part of that, not knowing it, for 40 years.
So for 40 years, you know you have the distinction of being the last crew on the last mission of the war.
Yeah.
But you don't know that without you guys flying over Tokyo, that the surrender might not have happened.
Yeah.
What did they tell you 40 years later?
Well, they didn't tell us anything. I mean, it was just made public or made available. The radio operator on my first crew wrote a book, The Last Mission, Jim Smith, and he wrote the first book on what happened on that last mission.
So help us understand the significance of that, of why the path of your mission actually affected whether or not the surrender happened.
Well, the radar system that Japan had picked up the fact that here were B-29s coming in towards Tokyo. They were afraid we were going to drop, another atomic bomb on Tokyo or on the Imperial Palace even. What they did then, they blacked out the whole area, including the Imperial Palace and so forth. All of the personnel of the Imperial Palace, including the Emperor, were in the dark, and most of them were in shelters. Herr Hato had decided that he would accept unconditional surrender, but he never talked to these people directly. It was always recorded. He'd record, and they'd play the recording, but he never would personally talk to these people.
Would never be a live broadcast. It was always done ahead of time.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so the recording that was made of the surrender was done at early evening. There was a group of the high command group of Japan that didn't agree with the emperor about surrendering. They wanted to keep on going. And so they figured that if they got a hold of that recording that was down in someplace in the Imperial Palace, they could destroy that and the people wouldn't know about it. And they would hold the emperor under control. Prison, I guess you'd say, or under arrest, so to speak. being that they had to block out, there was only light they had was flashlights they could use, and they tried to find that. Often they tried to go to the radio station where it was recorded to the people, and they didn't know where it was. And others that did know didn't tell them. I mean, they just didn't tell you. So they did capture the Imperial Palace personnel and imprisoned them, separated them out so that his message wouldn't go out to his people. Well, there was two groups, and so the group that wanted to surrender were strong enough to avoid the other group that wanted to keep on under control. So they lost their support, and the leaders of that committed suicide at that point. So at daybreak, shortly thereafter, I believe, the recording was put out, and it was unknown whether the people would accept what the emperor said. And one of the conditions that the surrender did offer was that Hirohito would not be killed. But anyway, he made they played the recording, and the people of Japan accepted what he said. Just amazing how he could control those many people of something that was so adverse to what he was asking them to do.
Yeah, because up till then, it had been an honor to die for the emperor.
Yeah, that's right.
He was a divine figure.
Afterwards, we found out they had a lot of kamikaze planes that they had stored. Some of these people just thought they could beat us with those kamikazes. And interestingly enough, years later, when I was out of the service and in business and selling merchandise that I'd raised in Japan, I was dealing with a person over there when I was over there selling citrus. We talked a little bit about that, you know, the surrender and so on. He says, well, I was a kamikaze pilot.
Really?
Yeah, and here was a guy just like you and I were sitting and doing business with, a nice guy. And I says, how come you would agree to that? He says, that was an honor to die. He says, there's no question of you. You just don't turn that down. Anyway, back to the surrender. It was totally accepted. There wasn't an active resistance to the emperor's surrender.
But if we add it all up, if you and all those other B-29s hadn't been flying that mission, which some people might say, hey, it was unnecessary, they're already going to surrender, you don't need to get that oil field.
Okay.
But if you didn't, those guys might have been successful in stopping the recording from being played, right?
Could have been, yeah. And Russia was supporting Japan, and yet Stalin was with Churchill and Truman, and Russia wanted, in the spoils of the thing, to have part of Japan, particularly up the areas where we, up in northern Hokkaido. But we didn't know that. We found that out later. But that's the reason that we had that mission, was to keep Russia from getting that when we knew that Japan was going to surrender. We didn't want Russia to have that property up there.
So it wasn't so much to take the oil away from the Japanese, it was to keep the USSR's hands off of it.
Yeah. Well, and off of the land.
Right.
See, they owned up to it. They were just going to expand their ownership of properties.
When you learned all of this 40 years later about that unknown consequence of that last mission, was that kind of mind-blowing for you?
Yeah, it was. We just, it made sense to us after they told us about that, but we had no idea about why that happened. So that was, there was nothing heroic about that. It was just part of the deal.
Well, you've been a part of a lot of history, haven't you?
It was a good trip.
I'm looking over here at a big sign that says, Happy 100th Birthday, Roger. Did you ever think, growing up, that you're going to be 100 years old?
No way. No way. I thought, boy, if I ever got to be 80 years old, I thought that would really be something.
And you didn't just make it to 100. Everybody can still hear how sharp your memory is, how able you are. You come to the office to keep up with work, and I'm pretty sure you drive yourself here, right?
Yes. Oh, I'm still driving, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not as sharp as I used to be, no question about that, but I'm able to function adequately to satisfy my needs, and so I'm very thankful for the good Lord giving me the years that I'm having, and so grateful for life.
When you got out of the military, you built a career in agriculture and developing property, real estate, and you're still at it at age 100.
I was fortunate that I had met some people that I associated with and started farming. I didn't have any money, but I would farm for people that did have the money that had the properties. And so out of that situation, with having some good people that I associated myself with, we established S&J Ranches, and at that time we got to where we developed. We were one of the largest farmers of citrus and pistachios in the area, and we were the largest producers of olives of anybody in the United States. And we didn't own those properties. We, like I say, we farmed them, but we were farming, and I planted lots of acreage to trees. I had a big nursery, grew good nursery trees, and then I built the first processing plant for pistachios that I sold to Sitton. I operated 3 citrus packing houses, one in Clovis, one in Exeter, and one in Tarabella. I've been fortunate to have, lucky to be with people that were good people. It was so nice from that standpoint. And I was pretty conservative. I didn't want to go into debt. Mm-hmm. I should have, but I didn't. But I'm okay.
Well, I know you're better than okay. And I've always been struck by the humility with which you carry yourself, given all your accomplishments. And I know you wouldn't say it, so I'll say it, but you've been very generous to your alma mater, and you've donated in significant amounts to Fresno State, specifically the Jordan College of Agricultural Science and Technology. The reason I bring that up is I'm curious why that was important to you.
When I went to Fresno State, I had to pay, my parents didn't pay the tuition. I had to work. So with that background, when my wife was still alive, she and I donated a fund and established what was called the Jensen Scholars. The earnings of that foundation provides full scholarship for 8 students, full scholarship for 8 students each year. And they had to be ag students. The decisions to make each year as to who to award those scholarships to, I wanted the real world to be part of that. So I said we'd have 7 people, 3 from a faculty, 3 from the real world, and a member of my family. I was denied a lot of activities when I went to college because I had to work.
Right.
So I figured if these guys didn't have to work because they had a scholarship, then they could participate in the fullest academically and socially in a college environment. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason that I did that. And to be eligible for one of these scholarships, they have to be majored in ag business or plant pathology in the ag school.
You would probably have some perspective on this because you've been around farming longer than most people have been alive. Is there something that you think the average person doesn't understand or misunderstands about farming?
Yes. I don't think that the general public appreciates the work ethic that the Mexican people have. They come in here and they will work where our people won't do it. And they become very talented. They earn good money because they learned how to do it. And so why are we not letting them be here?
So you think there are some progress that still needs to be made on the immigration front?
Yeah, yeah.
For creating a pathway to citizenship?
Yeah. They have a work ethic that's admirable. You know, if you work and achieve, you have a reward. You feel good about doing it. Like I said, I've had a world of experience of all kinds of situations.
Well, I think for most people that would make this question difficult, but maybe not for you. As you hit 100 years old and you look back over a whole century of life, is there something that you look at and you say, that's what I'm most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I'm thankful for my wife and my family.
Last question I have, unless there's anything else you want to work in there. Were there some people that you got to know in the war that didn't come home that are folks that you still think about every once in a while?
Yeah, my roommate, Mel Rao.
And he was your roommate at Fresno State, and he was a big football star at Fresno State.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen his Distinguished Flying Cross citation. He was a B-25 pilot.
down in North Africa and Italy, I believe. And so he was killed in a plane crash, right?
He was on a pleasure mission, a weekend excursion to get some candy or ice cream or something.
Well, and I guess what I'm interested in, so we understand what it was like then, because this, I mean, here he is, he's a college football player. If I go talk to some college football players right now, I don't think they would identify with that experience of a year later being flying in the war. When you got that news that that had happened to him, a guy that you used to live with, how did that affect you?
Well, you just had to accept it. It was part of the deal, and it's just too bad that the good person like that, he was a good person.
So when I asked you, were there guys that you knew, that was the first one you thought of was Mel Rao?
Yeah.
One of the 406,000 Americans who died in that war. How should we remember those guys all these years later?
I think we should respect our freedom and honor their lives. I don't have much sympathy for people that don't honor our country and freedom.
The latest to join the ranks of the centenarians, Roger Jensen, an example and an inspiration to many. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.